where he was able to juxtapose streamlined, bureaucratic, self-reproducing domination with only the supposedly liberating tendencies of the central plan and whatever still survives of Marxist ideology. Footnote 37a, text. It will easily be seen that in the absence of a single posture and definition, the genesis of a version of state capitalism represented by the New Deal was also conceived differently as democratic or manipulated. Those theorists who concentrated on the manipulated, closed authoritarian features of the system, Horkheimer, Adorno, Kirchheimer, and the late Marcuse, focused on the objectively necessary response of capitalism to crises and the conquest of the subjective factor by the political organizations of pluralist mass democracy and by the cultural industry in a manner analogous to the fascist psychoanalysis in reverse. The theorists who insisted on the juridical, legal protection of civil rights and the survival of some residues of popular political participation under late capitalism, Neumann and Pollock, postulated a New Deal type of system as the achievement of the democratic forces, unions, reformist parties, and so on, battling against the other historical alternatives. Fascism. Not surprisingly, the result led to at least two types of theories concerning the structure and the dynamics. Question 4, above, of the new social formation, the theory postulating the conquest of the subjective factor led to, or perhaps already presupposed, the Adorno-Horkheimer theory of the cultural industry and eventually to Marcuse's one-dimensional man. The theory focusing on the role of democratic mass movements led to Pollock's theory of state capitalism and eventually to the Offe-Habermas theory of political crises. Page 22. Since our concern in this chapter is the political sociology of the older Frankfurt School generation, we will concentrate especially on Pollock's theory. Pollock's state capitalism, reproduced below, is indeed open to the objection, for example Neumann's, that the elements of its basic model were put together from Pollock's studies, 1920s, and Soviet planning, from his work on Keynes, from his particular understanding of the Marxian crisis theory, and from his knowledge of the National Socialist economy. Footnote 38. Text. Closer analysis, of course, shows that the elements of this combination point to different social structures and the convergence of the economic structures of the post-liberal capitalist social formations is true only in carefully limited respects. Nevertheless, Pollock's essay, as well as Horkheimer's essays of 1940, are based on a powerful insight that validates the efforts from the start. The change in function of political economy, the end of the primacy of the economic under industrially advanced contemporary social formations, and the necessity of the replacement of political economy as the framework and object of Marxism as critique in state capitalism, and even more systematically, though less extensively, in the contemporary essay, Is National Socialism a New Order? Pollock investigates the structure of state capitalism by outlining the parameters of state regulation of an industrialized economy, of the class structure, and of the ideological integration. Here Marcuse's earlier and Adorno's later essays were more subtle, and political domination of individuals. He also did not forget the question about the future-oriented dynamics of the system. Also, Pollock boldly declared economic laws and economic crises tendencies to be dead. He did not, especially in state capitalism, postulate a stable society. His most important point in this context, the others were also worth the attention of the reader, was the postulate, presumably derived from Soviet experience, of the political struggle among different elite groups and indirectly the underlying population over the disposition and priorities of the undemocratic central plan. In other words, Pollock was moving towards a political crisis theory of state capitalism, later revived by such theorists as Sergei Mallet, Klaus Offe, and Jürgen Habermas. It is easily documentable that 1 year later, when Pollock wrote Is National Socialism a New Order, the dynamic aspects of his incipient crisis theory were replaced by a mere appeal to democratic forces to establish or to protect the right kind of state capitalism. A critical monograph on his work could probably show that having abandoned the classical Marxian dialectic of labor and consciousness that leads to the global subject of praxis, the revolutionary working class, without transforming the locus of critique to culture as well as politics, Pollock could in principle not discover any systematic possibility of a conscious challenge to state capitalist integration. Page 23. Hence, the most abstract of all possible answers, a moral appeal by the isolated theorist. Some of the recent works of Habermas, a student and associate of Adorno, throws much needed light on just this problem complex. The replacement of the critique of political economy by the critique of politics is not without consequences for the structure of critique itself. Classical political economy was not only an expression of the integration of liberal capitalism through the self-regulating market, it was also a key ideology, disguising class hierarchy through the appearances of equivalent exchange and grounding the formerly homologous but independently generated norms of liberty and equality interpreted in practice as liberty and equality of property owners. Footnote 39, text. The critique of political economy could be therefore both an imminent critique of the democratic norms of civil society in the context of their bourgeois deformation and the fetishizing critique of the socially necessary illusions of the stability and equilibrium of market-integrated capitalist economy. Footnote 39, text. In the form of imminent critique, the critique of political economy addresses the potential consciousness of the subjective agents that could transform capitalist society. In the form of defetishization, the same critique unfolds the framework of those economic crises that make this transformation objectively possible. However, the growth of state intervention destroys this solid link between the two types of critique in the works of Marx. State regulation of capitalist economies displays political economic controls into a political administrative sphere and at the same time places an entirely new burden given the decline of the normative ideological functions of the market in the context of state intervention and imperfect competition on the sphere of culture. The latter must now provide normatively compelling political legal legitimations and private personal motivations for the maintenance of the system. since the political administrative domain defends itself from public scrutiny precisely by means of the technological veil, a critique of technocratic politics for Habermas' systems theory may indeed reveal potential ruptures, for example, rationality crisis of state capitalists' integration. But only a critical analysis of the sphere of culture, where autonomous, self-generated norms may conflict with the ideological requirements of the system, can demonstrate and perhaps promote the possibility of conscious resistance by those whom the whole critical enterprise proposes to address. Page 24. Pollock's critique of the politics of state capitalism clearly omits this last step. But if a critique of politics alone replaces the critique of political economy, the system criticized, whatever its technical imbalances, will appear petrified or at most oscillating between disruption and readjustment. Hence the pessimistic outcome of Pollock's critique of politics. We must immediately ask whether those of Pollock's colleagues for whom culture rather than politics became the new object of critique, for whom the theory of the culture industry became the theory of late capitalism, were able to move toward a theory of the cultural crisis of state capitalism, a crisis theory that would indicate the new context of actively critical subjectivity. Therefore, we must look ahead for a moment to the theory of cultural industry. But here too, the abandonment of the revolutionary proletariat in the context of a hidden orthodoxy that possessed no other key to revolutionary emancipation meant the acceptance of a state view of the new social formation, instead of a framework of crises. Adorno and Horkheimer tended to see state capitalists or late capitalists' culture as that of inevitably manipulation and control operating on the total social level and in the personality structure of individuals. The reason for their profound pessimism is, however, just the opposite of Pollock's. Hidden orthodoxy, instead of the absence of cultural analysis, instead of linking cultural theory to the political crisis theory of state capitalist social formations that was available, in fact, in Pollock's work, they proceeded in the important book Dialectic of Enlightenment under the political impact of both the fascist experience and the disastrous fate of the Russian Revolution to anchor the critique of the late capitalist cultural industry in a destructive negative hermeneutics or philosophy of history of all civilization. Of Pollock's critique of politics, they have incorporated in the end only its pessimistic outcome. When, however, key concepts like reification, the fetish of technology, the petrification of language, and the mythological consequences of the Enlightenment struggle against myth are extended so as to cover all of history, and the very mode of the self-humanization of man in the animal world, no locus of liberation can be available in either past, present, or future culture. To be more precise, the locus of liberation then would be necessarily narrowed to the staunchest, most self-reflective and self-critical forms of criticism in autonomous art and critical philosophy. In the context of the genesis of Frankfurt cultural critique, this pessimistic answer was not preordained. Page 25. The debate between Walter Benjamin and T.W. Adorno, which we will present and explore in the next part, shows a fluid theoretical context that was frozen only somewhat later when a new philosophy of history, or rather a negative hermeneutics which universal aspirations swallowed temporarily, critical theory itself.